Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Economics. I'm Tim Jones. And while today's new book was published by Penguin in May, it is actually an old book, first published in 1954, and the new edition has simply rebranded it as a Penguin classic, and rightly so. The Great Crash 1929 by John Kenneth Galbraith, who died in 2006, is a classic of clearly written economics for the general reader, packed with lessons for today. Some of these are picked out by his son, James Kenneth Galbraith, in his introduction to the book, which was written in the wake of the financial crisis in 2008-9. Like his father, James Galbraith is an economist and public intellectual. He holds the Lloyd Benson Chair in Government Business Relations at the LBJ School of Public Affairs and is professor in government at the University of Texas at Austin. He's the author of many books, the most recent of which are The End of Normal, Why the Growth Economy Isn't Coming Back, Welcome to the Poison Chalice, The Destruction of Greece and the Future of Europe, and Inequality, What Everyone Needs to Know. James, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you very much. It's great to be with you.
I mean, I chose this book for the podcast because it was the first economics book I ever read, because my father had a copy from when he was a student in the 50s, so it's probably one of the early editions. Margaret Thatcher had just been elected for the first time, and I was a teenager with no knowledge in economics, but it was understandable, and it was a real page-turner. It's been nearly 70 years since it was published, but do you still hear that kind of thing from people today about what this book meant to them?
Oh, the book is, yes, it's never actually been out of print, except possibly for a few weeks in 1989, just before, or 87, I guess, just before the stock market dropped by 30% in that October of that year. And it was very rapidly brought in back into print at that time. So it has become part of the canon of a book that I think practically anybody who wants to understand the instability of modern finance is aware of and needs to have read, and I could tell you some other people, some of the specific stories about people who've mentioned it to me.
Please go ahead.
Just mention that in 2003, I was in, of all places, Havana, and I had a conference on economics and globalization, and I happened to have an encounter with a comandante en jefe, none other than Fidel Castro. And the moment he saw my name, he said, "Ah, The Great Crash, my favorite book. I have a copy on my night table." So I just reported that back to my father, who was quite pleased.
I'll bet. Well, I read that he wrote it over one summer while your family was staying in Vermont. As an author yourself, do you think that's why it reads so well? He didn't have a chance to overthink it?
Yeah, that's correct. I think at the end of someone suggested to him that the crash of 1929 had never been properly written up. There's greatly overtaken by the Depression, the New Deal, and the war, and so he just set out and went to the Baker Library at Dartmouth College, and wrote it from the contemporary, largely from the contemporary accounts. Some books, but also largely the newspapers and other records of that particular period. It was a quickly done book over the course, as you say, of a summer in Vermont. Mm.
Although I read that your mother wasn't too pleased because he'd been working very hard during the rest of the year, and suddenly he was gone for most of the summer to look, and she had to look after you.
That's possible. At that time, I would have been 2 to 3 years old. So I guess it came out in 1954. I was a toddler, and my mother also had my brother Peter, who was a year older than I am, and of course much more trouble than I was.
Well, as you say, you'd have been too young to remember, but that summer on the farm. But do you remember his writing process with any of the other books? Some of them being easier than others.
Oh, sure. He was an exceedingly disciplined writer and had a very set schedule. He would set off in the morning. He would write for 3 or 4 hours. He would be done at lunchtime. In the afternoons, for other purposes, including going, if we were in Vermont in the summertime, going out for a walk. In term time at Harvard, he set his schedule so that he said, I don't teach in the morning and I don't teach in the afternoon. He taught a class that was strictly at noon. And so that basically divided his day. And his writing process was also as disciplined as the hours, insofar as he would write a draft. It would then leave his hands, go to an assistant to be typed, usually I think in triple spaces, come back to him a few days later for revision, go back. And this process would be done 6 or 7 times. With the result, by the way, since he had an exceptionally careful and diligent editorial and staffing assistants, that every draft of every chapter of every manuscript was preserved in orderly files, and they're all now accessible at the Kennedy Library in Boston.
So he was writing in longhand and someone else was typing them up?
Initially, I think perhaps the first draft might have been a longhand draft, although he did type on a typewriter. But once they were typed, then he would just simply revise by interleaving with notes in longhand.
Mm. Well, I mean, we've had more than half a century of new scholarship on the crash and the depression since the book was written. How do you think it stands up?
Well, I think the reason it's still in print and still read is that people keep coming back to it as a foundational text. Now, admittedly, it's an account that it has a considerable, let's say, popular and cultural element to it, it's graced with my father's gift of phrasing. But there was a period when there was a rather turgid academic economists were saying, no, the stock market really didn't matter, that the depression was already baked in the cake before the collapse of September, October 1929. And so they tried to read it out. And that basically didn't work. It was part of an ideology which essentially marginalized and put to aside the functioning of the core institutions of financial capitalism. What banks do, what commercial banks do, investment banks do, and so forth, doesn't really matter. The scams that they engage in don't really matter. What matters is more obscure process in the so-called real economy. But that was never my father's view. My father's view was that these things are deeply integrated, and the instability of finance can contribute in a massive and abrupt way to the failure of the underlying system, and that's what happened in 29-30.
Mm. Well, he died at the age of 97, 2 years before the 2008 crash, and your introduction to the book updates Galbraithian thinking around that. The Penguin Classic hasn't updated the introduction, but effectively you've done so with an essay in Foreign Policy that came out in January, what you call it, The Forgotten Prophet, in which you argue that, quote, the pandemic has now put Galbraith's global legacy into stark relief. Could you take us through your argument in that essay?
Yes, what I argue there, and this was for Foreign Policy, so I gave it a kind of global international cast, that what's happened in the economies of the United States, the United Kingdom predominantly, it has been a concentration of activities in the financial sector, an enormous increase in the reach and importance of that sector internally and externally, a certain amount of, but in the last 15 years, eroding position in a correspondingly advanced technology enterprises, which are basically supplying capital goods to the world economy. And then below that level, everything that's all the jobs created are created in services, the personal services of various kinds, which are not terribly well paid, but do provide a lot of employment. And that this then, obviously, the missing middle is what has traveled to Asia. And if you look at the Asian economies, to some degree also the German economy, but you look particularly at the Asian economies, what you find is that they continue to represent to be essentially centered around the large stable industrial firms, the planning sector that form the core object of my father's later work, particularly of the new industrial state, which is his most, perhaps his most important contribution to the body of economic thought. The result of this is that you can see the difference in performance, that our economies, particularly the American and the British, were extremely fragile. Were hit in ways by the pandemic that are not easy to deal with, that are going to require major transformations if they can be dealt with at all. Whereas if you look at China, if you look at Korea, if you look at Japan, something of a more mixed case at this point, but you look around the world at what I call the Galbraithian economies. They are substantially, they were adapted more quickly. They were more resilient, and they came back much more rapidly in a much more comprehensive way than we did. And in fact, they were able, because they were able to supply themselves with their needs, and to mobilize the whole population in a way that the Western economies were not, they were able to actually suppress the pandemic rather than simply mitigating it and waiting for vaccines to come along to bring it to an end.
I mean, obviously, the thing people talk about there is a deep difference in culture, culture of governance. Do you think that kind of suppression could have been suppression?
That's what people pandemic. Always say when they don't understand what's going on. Mm-hmm. Nobody in 1960 thought that Korea or China had a culture of governance that was likely to produce an effective result in a situation like this. And those countries were, and China in particular, very disorderly at that time. Mm. But the fact that they have developed along certain lines and sustained the building of an industrial society with core technical competences, core manufacturing abilities, and with directed essentially at the corporate level by enterprises with long-term objectives, long-term perspectives, and that are not driven by short-term profit maximization, that are not subject to the diktat of Wall Street consultants, that are protected to a degree from financial manipulations, from scams, from get-rich-quick schemes, from pyramid schemes, from everything that's described as having affected Wall Street in 1929 and the Great Crash. These are the reasons why these countries are able to deal with crises of these kinds more effectively than we have been. And we were in this position. I mean, what they did, if you look at the post-war development of Germany and Japan, and also of Korea and also of China, you discover that they were taking a good deal of their initial impetus from the American model, from the model of the New Deal, and from the American corporation of the post-war period. That was what their economies essentially were built upon, and they learned about these things, and to a very substantial degree, by reading my father. I discovered this in China in the early 1990s. I went out as under a UN, United Nations Development Program contract as an advisor to the State Planning Commission, which is the very center of the Chinese decision-making process, certainly at the time. When I was invited to effectively audition for this position as a part-time consultant there, and it was a training. It was basically training and educational exercise. After hearing me out over a period of some hours, my audience, who consisted of section chiefs and so forth, all brought out copies of my father's books that had been translated internally, unofficially, and they asked if I would sign them, which I, of course, was delighted to do. But the reality was that particularly in the post Mao period, these people who were thinking about how to develop their economy were thinking very much along Galbraithian lines.
Mm. Well, I was actually referring to the governance of the pandemic when I rather than economic governance, but I completely take your point. Coming back to something you wrote in the introduction, and again, you were referring to something he said in the book about the golden age for professors and the way that the economics profession developed after the crisis. In April, you wrote another very interesting essay for Foreign Policy. This one, "The Death of Neoliberalism is Greatly Exaggerated." And in this, you point out that the 2008 crisis dented economic orthodoxy, but the pandemic blew it apart. Can you take us through the argument in that essay, and especially your call for a new generation of what you call scholar practitioners to take over the profession?
Yeah. Well, in 2008, they economics profession put on a great show of pretending that nothing could be foreseen. This is a well-known episodes, including the question posed by Her Majesty the Queen to Tim Beazley and his colleagues. Embarrassed and somewhat sheepish responses. But at the end of the day, nothing happened in the profession. Nobody who had, in fact, did foresee it or who understood why the system was prone to blow apart in such a dramatic way received any recognition from mainstream academic economics. Not a single senior professor was appointed to any out of the ranks of the critics and dissidents to any position. In fact, the mainstream went on a major counterattack, trying to disparage and run down the challenges that they found they couldn't entirely ignore, and this carried on until the pandemic, and the pandemic blew the system apart in at least a serious, I think in many ways more serious and fundamental way, and in a way which unmistakably provoked a policy reaction that had to be immediate, dramatic, totally against the instincts of the mainstream of the economics profession. So in April of last year, the United States Congress under a Republican president quickly enacted a, 10% of GDP spending program to keep people's incomes afloat in the period when the employment was collapsing at a rate that we've never experienced, I think, in any in recorded history, in fact. And, you know, by and large, it worked. And it was perhaps not as smoothly done as it might have been, but getting income into people's bank accounts, getting cash into their bank accounts, kept them afloat. Kept the society from falling apart in this country over the course of the summer and fall. We, without any of the inflation, runaway price increases that some people who were operating on other assumptions, on the mainstream assumptions, in some cases were warning about. So here we are, by a series of happenstances, we got a change of administration, change of control of the Congress, in the early periods of 2021, we're looking at a moment, one of the rare moments in certainly in my professional life, that progressive possibilities have opened up. They may not be exploited to the extent that we need, but they're substantially greater than anybody in my position thought was going to be possible last summer. That again, you can hear the complaints of a small number of the old guard of the mainstream economists, but it's very clear that they're complaining out loud because people are not listening to them in private. And this is good. This is good, but it still leaves the question of what's going to happen to the economics profession going forward. To the extent that it retains any influence at all, it needs to be it needs basically a turnover of personnel. And the question is then, since the mainstream of the economics profession has not been extracting and bringing out and training new economists who are particularly useful, where are you going to find these people? And the answer to that, in my view, is that it's going to look very much, if it's going to happen, it has to look very much like what happened in the New Deal and in the Second World War in this country, where people were brought in to achieve certain goals, to rebuild certain sectors, agriculture, industry, infrastructure, you name it, and energy in our case. And when we've achieve some of that, those people should come back, should be the people who are become the teaching and core and who form the next generation of economists, if we're going to have a next generation of economists. It should not be, we should not continue to privilege a tribe that has dug itself into a deep intellectual hole and has nothing much to say about the current problems, and it is not being contributing in any constructive way to dealing with what we're trying to deal with now.
So you're thinking of people who are currently working in Treasury, the White House, the Fed.
Here and in other countries, I mean, people who are actively intervening in an effective way and who can demonstrate that they're playing an important role. Yeah, but also, I mean, you need to broaden out the definition of what an economist is. We are going to have to reconstruct the social systems that provide employment, because otherwise we're not going to absorb the millions of people, reabsorb the millions of people who have been displaced by the pandemic. We're going to have to rebuild our social insurance system so that people have a decent modicum of security, retirement, health, and other areas. We are going to have to reconstruct our energy systems and deal with climate change. So this requires people who have some understanding of the engineering issues that are involved here. So there, a broader, more engaged, more technically competent, if you like, real world, savvy group of people. In the period that we were talking about in the immediate aftermath of the crash of 29, the economists who were relevant. And my father was an example of this. He came into the federal government for the first time in the summer of 1934, working for the Agricultural Adjustment Administration. What did he know about? He knew about farming. He knew about beekeeping. He knew about a number of specific issues, marketing in agriculture. These things are this was at the core of what of a major part of the crisis, which was the crisis of American agriculture. It was the collapse of American agriculture. People who knew about that were what was required. His interest then moved on, and he became very much centered on the industrial system. But there again, what he knew was about how corporations function and how industrial systems function. He applied that knowledge and acquired more in the immediate aftermath of the war. He was director of the Strategic Bombing Survey, so he was able to assess what had happened in Germany and Japan, and in fact realized that the bombing campaign against the German economy had not been effective. One of the things that happens when you bomb a factory is that you simply accelerate the depreciation of machines that are being replaced anyway, so that actually speeds up modernization. These kinds of things are things that people know if they have some connection to the real world. If you're sitting in an academic economics department, you learn nothing about this. There's no, the whole profession is sealed off in a miasma of algebra and economic statistics, many of which are in fact not understood by the people who are using them. So it really has a crisis of an intellectual community who's that's in many ways clearly past its sell-by date.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
Yeah, you make another very salient point in the piece where you, the same piece, where you argue that the massive increase in liquidity and debt won't lead to inflation in the traditional sense, but quote, bidding up the price of stocks, land, and housing, so they further enrich the already well-to-do. And I wonder, there is a tendency, as you know, there's a tendency of economists to fight the last war. And I wonder whether your scholar practitioners who've been blooded by this crisis would have the right focus and incentives to deflate assets. And how would they do it?
Well, we're seeing some discussion of that. And I think this is a very interesting issue, because here is where you get into a discussion of the taxation of wealth in particular, and economists who have, I think, progressive instincts, but who have been talking about, let's say, imposing Elizabeth Warren's proposal for a 2% tax on appraised wealth each year. This something which requires the eye of someone who knows about tax law and tax administration, which is something that academic economists tend not to know very much about, and perhaps don't even care very much about, because for them it's to a degree a theoretical exercise or an ideological exercise. But the reality is, if you're writing tax, writing tax law, you need to know how taxes function and how the business of appraisal and assessment is actually carried out, and that will then give you a different perspective, and it would lead me in particular to say, don't do it that way. The way things to focus on are land and land equivalent, like intellectual property rights, copyrights, and patents, and so forth, mineral rights. These are fixed assets which can be appraised and can be taxed, and which are highly concentrated. And if you want to improve the distribution of this in the system and the financing of the public sector, that's where you should focus your efforts. The other area that I would point to is, because we have a tax that works on it, is estates and gifts. And the virtue of those is that they are appraised just once. You freeze assets when someone dies, and appraise them and tax them, and that gives an enormous incentive to people who have large accumulations to give them away before they die to tax exempt entities, to universities, hospitals, churches, cultural facilities, which is of course a major piece of what provides employment and also enriches the life, certainly in this country. So thinking about what actually works and what can be administered through the tax code is something those people should be teaching the economists, not listening to economists who are conjuring up things that can't actually be implemented.
In your articles for Project Syndicate, you really changed your mind about President Biden in the wake of the American Rescue Plan and now the infrastructure plan. You touched on this earlier. This has been a crisis of such scale that it would have changed anybody. But are you surprised at how radical he has been? And has it been the influence of any advisors in particular that you know of?
Well, yes, I've been favorably surprised. I was obviously not a supporter of President Biden's in the primaries. I have been associated with Bernie Sanders for quite a few years. I never played a major role in his campaign. But the whole drift of the spring primaries and the convention, I found, it was in some ways a little bit demoralizing, and then things started to change. Over the campaign, first of all, candidate Joe Biden adopted a strategy of calm and reserve, discovered that this resonated with the population. And then as he assembled his administration, he drew upon, first of all, people who knew how to function as staff and people who knew how to function in the Washington political environment. So he drew heavily from the progressive think tanks, and he didn't simply go out and pull down the same people from prestige economics departments. He wasn't seeking to burnish his administration by bringing people in simply because they had positions in some place that had some reputation, which is exactly what did happen, frankly, in the Obama administration. When you looked at the people who were brought in, and thinking about people like Jared Bernstein and Heather Bauche, and then bringing Janet Yellen to the Treasury, who was a very seasoned practitioner, you've got a group that, first of all, understands the byways of the capital, And then along with the president also understands that you don't have much time, that normally, particularly if you have a very narrow congressional majority, and of course, this was the other big gift, which was the Senate runoffs in Georgia, which were heavily influenced by one of my former students, the great Stacey Abrams, and really put together a transforming political coalition in that state, gave the Democrats a very narrow majority, which may or may not hold. And that gives you a strong incentive to do as much as possible in a short period of time. And put those things together with maybe one other thing, which is that Joe Biden himself has been around. When you're 78 or 79, you naturally don't think of yourself as having an enormous amount of time. You're not looking ahead 10 or 15 or 20 years. But you also have experience. You know that the successful cases, whether you agreed with them or not, of American politics are people who acted quickly. It's true of Roosevelt. It's true of Reagan. It's true of LBJ in 1965. And so taking advantage of your opportunities is a lesson that really seasoned politicians, I think, absorb. So all of these things came together in a way which, it's fair to say, I didn't fully anticipate, but I highly appreciate it. It's a rare moment, and let's hope that it deepens rather than fades.
Well, I mean, European governments have been criticized for being far less ambitious than the Biden administration. Do you even partially accept a European argument that less needs to be done countercyclically because welfare systems and healthcare systems in Europe are already much more efficient safety nets? Or do you
absolutely do not accept it? And I think anybody who's been in the who knows the healthcare systems in France or Italy knows how terribly starved of resources, or Greece for that matter, overstressed those people are, and how much that is the fault of the doctrines of austerity which have been inflicted on them for the last certainly the last 15 years, maybe the last 40 years, actually. In a way, which is simply not true in the United States. We may have a very inefficient and wasteful system, but we're spending twice as much on healthcare as the Europeans are, just to take that one sector. And I think twice as much on public, on higher education than Europeans do as a share of a very much larger GDP per capita as well. So I absolutely do not accept it. The Europeans have dug themselves into a hole of their own making, allowed essentially a class of hyper-conservative creditors, strongly influenced by the traditions of von Hayek and von Mises, and what's called the ordo-liberal thinkers of the mid-late 20th century, take control of their systems, and they're going to pay and are paying a fearsome price. And when you compare it to what is happening in other parts of the world, where countries are able to mobilize resources and have done so with a real technical ability, you're going to see the Europeans falling very, very far behind. I mean, again, I come back to China. China mobilized its resources. It dealt with the pandemic, and it's back to both the normal level of economic activity, but ongoing economic development. Clearly visible in the kinds of engineering initiatives that you see going on in that country, the construction of things. This is really seeing, unfortunately, Europe and take China, the U.S., and Europe. Europe's really in the laggard position here. In the U.S., I think we have lost an enormous amount of technical capacity, and doing the things that the administration would like to do is going to prove to be quite difficult. Difficult to reshore production, difficult to do the engineering that we need to do to deal with climate change, because we don't have the human resources and the technical resources, the production resources. We've facilitated their offshoring and erosion, but at least recognizing that this is what we need to do and putting some finance and some political will is a start. And saying, well, everything's going to be all right. This phrase, countercyclical, just is an idea that everything's going to return to normal on its own. And this is an error. Things are not going to return to normal on their own. Human societies have to build their futures. They don't just ride roller coasters that are given to them from the outside. It's a huge intellectual failing leading to a political failing, leading to an economic failing.
Well, I mean, coming right back to the Great Crash and the 1920s, obviously there are people talk about similarities of coming out of the Spanish flu epidemic and then followed by the Roaring Twenties. Do you share that view that we could be looking at another equivalent boom to the one your father wrote about in his book?
Coming out of the Spanish flu in the First World War, no, I don't think we're looking at that. If we're looking at anything, it's an initiative that is comparable, should be compared to the New Deal, which is to say, what you do when the system, the previously existing system, no longer carries credibility. In 1933, when Roosevelt came in, the alternative was not capitalism or a return to normal. There were no economists saying things are going to just go back if you do nothing. That had been the mantra for four solid years under Hoover, and nobody believed it. The alternatives were communism and fascism. And if you didn't want those things, then you had to do something else, and Roosevelt found that something else. And that something else was democratic, it was energetic, and it had a vast element of cultural development, social development, infrastructure development, poverty alleviation, full employment, all kinds of things that essentially put the United States in the position to be the leading power for the second half of the 20th century. We're not all the way there to replicating that. We may not have the resources and advantages that we had in 1933, but you look around the world, it's that spirit which is going to move countries forward. The ones that do it best are the ones who are going to come out of this the best. Again, thinking about this as being on the cusp of another 1920s boom, we already did that once in the 21st century and ended in 2008. I don't see it happening anytime soon. If anything, the things that we're already doing in the financial sector are threatening the viability of a new turn, and that really have to be dealt with and to a degree regulated and suppressed. SPACs and so forth. I mean, there's the financial sector hasn't gone away, and it still represents very significant dangers to the stability of the economy.
Okay. Well, to finish, because this is a podcast about books, I ask every guest to choose a book or even two to recommend to listeners. What have you chosen?
I would actually recommend two books. One of them is a marvelous account that includes a good deal about my father's life and times, and it's Zachary Carter's The Price of Peace, and his biography. Largely focused, I mean, it's a biography of John Maynard Keynes, but it extends beyond that, and in many ways is one of the best accounts of the way in which my father took up and brought forward, but also differed from the legacy of Keynes in the United States. So highly recommended, The Price of Peace by Zachary Carter. And the other one is a book that's going to appear shortly from an academic press. It's from Routledge, and it's by a young scholar named Isabella Weber, an economist of German origin, now at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, and who is a really fundamental expert on China. And her book is entitled How China Escaped Shock Therapy. And it deals with the decisions that were taken in the post-Mao era based on a lot of field research. And one of the things that Isabella Weber really uncovered, which was a revelation to me when I read the manuscript, was the extent to which the Chinese of this period were basing their decisions to not go the route of the Big Bang of Milton Friedman's massive liberalization, not go the route that the Soviet Union took or the Russia took after the Soviet Union collapsed, but to build on what they had, so that they were following what they believed the United States had done in the war under my father's administration of the Office of Price Administration, and they were reading his books about and particularly the American Corporation, the New Industrial State, and his other works. As I mentioned earlier, I discovered that on my own a little bit in the 1990s when I arrived in China. But again, this book is a very important contribution to understanding what's going on in that part of the world.
And do you know when that's being published?
It will be published, I believe. I think the date is now like the 28th of May by Routledge. Right. Yeah.
Okay. Well, today I've been talking to James K. Galbraith about The Great Crush 1929 by John K. Galbraith, republished this month, May 2021, as a Penguin Classic. James, thanks again for coming on.
It's a great pleasure. It's wonderful talking to you.